obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I was under the impression that I was just speaking and not being roasted. Yeah, that's my wonderful co-chair, everybody, who's tolerated my lack of sleep all weekend. Hi, I'm Andrew, by the way. I should probably get to that part, or if you're one of my loving Alateen sparkles, which I'm not getting into why. I've been in and out of program my entire life. When I was a kid, my parents would take me and my brother to their AA meetings and their Al-Anon meetings, their NA meetings and OA meetings, and just lots of weird church basements with no toys and boredom. But the stories were interesting because they always felt like something we shouldn't be allowed to hear, like just a little bit, just a tad inappropriate. For us, though, it was... The experience as a kid almost kept me out of program, and I wish that I had embraced it sooner, because I think it would have made a lot of my struggles earlier in my life much easier if I had had preteen and stuff like that. But as it turns out, I actually fought entering Alateen tooth and nail. My dad had told us that my brother and I, he'd been telling us for over a year at this point. We had known about it for most of our lives, but we'd always avoided it. He told us that there was an Alateen meeting on Thursday night down at the church across from my high school. And I really didn't want to go at all, because I was afraid that, number one, there'd be people I knew. Number two, I would be bored. No offense, guys. I love you. And that I would be bored. And just three, it just seemed like it wouldn't help anything. And so what happened was my brother and I got into progressively more violent physical altercations. And finally, after one particularly bad one that I'm not going to get into, my dad told us, you guys are done. You're done. We had one of those like weird come to Jesus meetings where he just looks you in the eyes and you have to sit in the back seat of the car and you just don't talk. And if you say anything, you are dead. It's not even okay. And so he looked at us. He's like, you guys are done. You're going to a meeting this Thursday. You guys are going to five meetings. And if at the end of the five meetings you still don't like it, then you don't have to go anymore. And I'll never bring it up again. But until then, I expect you to be at each and every meeting exactly at 7:30. Yeah. So we went to the first meeting, and when I walk in, the first thing I notice is that there's three people from my high school there. One of which I wrestled with and was really good friends with. And it was funny, it actually became our little like secret thing we would talk about at wrestling practice. We would look at each other and be like, yo man, like you going to Thursday? It was like Fight Club, it was so weird. And so I, at the end of the first meeting, my brother and I got in the back seat of my dad's like weird like 73 Impala that now just doesn't run because it's a big pile. And he looked at us and he was like, how was the meeting? Did you guys like it? And we were like, it was all right. I mean, might go back. It's been 6 years. I don't know why I'm still here. I'm just kidding. I love you guys. But so my actual story, I'm getting a call, that's so weird, I should have left this. And what happened was, when I was four, my dad relapsed. He'd had about 7 years in program at that point. He might have had longer, but I know that there was another relapse before then. And he's not in here. I told him he's not allowed to come. I was like, nope, that ain't happening. I know there's a CD. You're not allowed to buy that either. But when I was... Darn. I'm trying really hard not to cuss. But so when I was four, my dad relapsed. And with his relapse also came my parents' divorce. And so... say a lot, it's pretty sweet, that vocabulary. Jenny was right about me not being able to form sentences, I apologize. But when they got divorced, My brother and I were split. We would only see my dad every other weekend. And my mom is a qualifier too, so I always feel kind of bad talking about just my dad in meetings. And so sometimes I have to kind of share the wealth as that as that goes, where you're like, oh, well, I'll just complain about my mom this week. And like a normal teenager does. And so I, and when we were going through it, it just seemed like that was how life had always been. I couldn't remember a time when they weren't divorced and when my dad wasn't using, or my dad wasn't missing big things because he was in prison, or because he just always seemed off, and because he was making a lot of money and we would still be in this ratty apartment in Hollywood that had roaches everywhere, and you'd just be like, I thought dad had a good job. And it just, it didn't matter. And as I got older, and he started working at, like, he started plumbing and stuff, and he got his act together, and my brother and I got to have that, like, conversation with our parents, like, 6 years too late after the divorce, where, you know, when you're a kid and your parents get divorced, and you're like, all right, I'm going to stay at whichever the chiller parents' house is, or whoever has the nicer house, and it was just like, all right, which double-wide mobile home do we want to stay in? And so we... I love my parents, I swear. And, but so we stayed with my mom. My mom had custody. And I was going through a ridiculously rough time. It wasn't the divorce. The divorce didn't bother me so much, because even when my parents got back together briefly, my sister and I were making bets on how long till it crumbled. Because we love them, and we want them to be happy. And we knew that if they were together, they would not be happy. And so we... I'm rambling. We... As I got older, I entered high school, and even though I had my meeting, I wasn't working my program. It took me a while to start being able to work a really good program. I would go to the meetings every week, and I would listen, and I would be touched, and I would absolutely love hearing what everybody had to say. But I started my meetings when I was a freshman in high school, and my sophomore year in high school is still the hardest year of my life. I'm not an AA speaker or an NA speaker, but it's like I struggled with my own addictions. I struggled with my own problems with depression and anxiety and panic attacks and everything else. And it wasn't, and well, following that wonderful, successful year of positive decisions, I entered a relationship where I got to acquire a new qualifier. That was awesome. And because Al-Anon relationships are so good decisions. If I had coffee, that's when I would take a sip to kind of ease the awkward tension. but I, gosh, how long do I have left? I should be checking. I was going to set a stopwatch, but I came up here and my phone started ringing. I was like, oh, geez. I started, when I was in that relationship, it lasted for a little bit longer than a year. I've realized since that the girl has her own problems, and I don't need to save them. I can try to help in the best way I can. We're not together anymore, but I still get calls from her from time to time when there's a crisis. And I don't know if I want to say too nice of a guy to say, I don't want to talk to you, but that I totally don't want to talk to her. And I'm just going to make myself laugh. That's just how this is going to work, guys. As long as I'm laughing, it's cool. I'm entertained. following that year, I wasn't in program for that year-long relationship. And after it, the first thing I did the week after we broke up was I went to my meeting. It was the first time I had been into my meeting in a year. And I walked in, and I saw Christy, and she gave me a big hug. And I thought I was going to faint. I just was so overwhelmed because I had been bottling up in a ridiculous amount of emotions. And there was a lot of ones that I hadn't been able to address because I had been out of program anyway. So it was just a double whammy of just awful, awful emotion. And I went into that meeting and I shared. And I didn't cry because I'm a total man. And I I cried a little bit. Real men cry. And... I went to SCAC, and not everybody knows what SCAC is, and some of you don't like it because we're loud. And I went to SCAC, and it was my second SCAC because I had missed a year, And that was one of the worst mistakes of my life, because missing a skak is awful. That is just never a good decision. As much as your body would prefer that you not go, just because you don't sleep. I haven't slept this weekend. Skak is worse. I'm surviving on like caffeine and nicotine right now, and that's all. Eventually, I got asked to be the co-chair last year. I had the honor of introducing Trish, who was amazing last year. And that was my first experience with actually being of service and being on committee and not just bringing literature or helping with a fundraiser, actually having a position and having a responsibility that you needed to get to. And so I got brought in really late to be her co-chair, just because someone else wasn't able to fulfill their duties. But I stepped up, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. It was really stressful, but it was one of the best experiences of my life. And immediately following that was the next GAC following my breakup, and I had been asked to be a speaker at this GAC. And once again, I didn't sleep. I was up for about 54 hours. I was one of those people that wrote down a checkpoint list of all the things that I wanted to cover. And I walked up, and I could hear the giggling from the back of the room. And I started to read it, and my hands were shaking. And I look out, and I see 400 teenagers. And I was like, this is the toughest crowd I'm ever going to have to deal with. This is not okay. Also, I'm leading the Saturday morning meeting. Nobody is awake. And I could see all of them, like just sunglasses, like dudes, we're in a church. Like, and I had to speak for 20 minutes on like the 12 steps, and I wasn't always awesome at working my program, so I didn't even know them all off the top of my head. Still don't. I love you, Christy. I really hope that's not on the CD. But I spoke, and that was the moment that it just really just clicked for me. I realized that being of service was the thing that I loved to do, because not only did it mean that you were one of the cool kids with a weird cutoff tank top and an oddly colored shirt, because we never pick good scat colors, but because I'm just knocking, who's committee here? I don't want to know. I spoke for 20 minutes, and I tried really hard not to cry on the stage. And when you're standing there trying not to cry in front of 400 teenagers, you're just like, man, I just stopped being the cool kid. This is not okay. And I started to choke up, and like three kids in the back, all simultaneously, without missing a beat, looked at me and yelled, "We love you." Which, when someone's trying to cry, that's simultaneously the most helpful and the like most devastating thing they could possibly say, because you're just like, love, I'm dead, I can't deal with this appreciation and respect and compassion. Those aren't things I'm familiar with. And someone really needs to tell me how long they have left. 2 minutes. Okay, I got this. Guys, we just went over this. This is ridiculous. I'm tired of this. I'm just tired. It's not even okay. I'm going to keep saying it's not even okay. That's going to be my new slogan. I'm going to introduce it into Alatine. It's not even okay. It's going to be in the book next year. make myself laugh. I was of service, and it was the best experience of my life. And now this year, I'm chairman. And I don't know how that happened. Someone messed up. But we've had one of the most stressful weekends, period. We've just had every curveball we could possibly think get thrown at us. And every time I started to get frustrated, I would have someone walk up to me. And the first thing they would ask is if I wanted a cigarette. But then after that, they were like, all right, no, okay, actual helpful things that won't just kill you. And they would be like, well, do you need us to do anything? What can we do to be there for you? What can we do to be of service to you so that we can get you through this weekend alive? And I would look at them and I would say, I need to sit and relax, say the serenity prayer, smoke the cigarette, to be honest. And every single thing that came up, we dealt with. It got handled. We let go and let God. And it was amazing to see how everything just wasn't easy, but definitely worked out. And that's how it's been with my program, with dealing with all of the not abuse to like me per se, but well, especially not from my parents, but like dealing with my own abuse, dealing with depression, dealing with having to decide that I have some kind of misguided messiah complex where I need to save my brother and I need to save my sister and I need to save my mom and I need to save my dad. And it's all people that not need to take care of themselves, but until I was a teen, I didn't realize I needed to take care of myself first. And this is, I love this program, it's ridiculous. You guys are ridiculous with your hugs. No, they're awesome, I love them, always give hugs. I love you. We went over this, guys. I appreciate it, I really do. Sparkles, God. Okay, thank you so much for listening to me ramble.
We're so gifted. Thank you, God. All right, the next person that will introduce the Al-Anon speaker is Karen Jay. Is she here? Here. Yeah, okay. Come on down.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Grateful member of Al-Anon. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry said, "It is only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye." It has been my experience in Al-Anon that upon meeting somebody for the first time, I feel an instant connection. There are no strangers here. The lady I'm about to introduce is no exception. It gives me great pleasure. Please welcome Jean B. from Northridge.
I may need some water, so honey, come to my rescue if I need it. Hi, I'm Jean. I am such a grateful member of Al-Anon, and let me tell you, my first meeting when I heard that, I did not understand it. It repulsed me, kind of. I mean, I just did not understand that. How do I follow Andrew? Oh, thank you, Andrew, so much. I love Alateens. Thank you. We love you. Now, I need to hear, I mean, he's getting "we love you" from his peeps. I need "we love you." Thank you. A room of Al-Anons, we're very helpful. I know. Oh my gosh, I want to thank the committee so much for such a warm welcome this weekend. And, you know, it's a little awkward for my, well, I can speak for myself, but we were talking about this for the two of us because we've been really involved. I've been really involved in convention work, but I'm always on the giving side, not on the receiving side, you know. So this is a little different. So thank you so much. Let me see. Where do I start? At the beginning. I walked into these rooms in 1980 for the first time. It wasn't my only time, but it was my first time. And I was so confused, so scared, feeling so abandoned, so betrayed. You know, I had been vulnerable with one person. That was Tom and I were married at that time. And you know, our relationship, it seemed like we had been in this relationship, to me, like for an eternity. You know, I was saying I think we had been married 12 years, but in fact we had only been married 7 years, but it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work for me. And when we share, I talk about I was the, you know, he was the runner and I was the stalker. That was our relationship, you know, and it was, oh my gosh. I did not grow up in active alcoholism, but I did grow up with the residuals of alcoholism and with the disease. And I'm not quite sure how that affected me, except I'll just tell you that my mother was orphaned when she was two. Her mother died. My grandmother died. And hearsay is that my grandfather was a drunk and, you know, couldn't make a living, and my mother was orphaned and never went back to that home. He remarried and had 10 children, and she wasn't a part of that. So there was abandonment issues there, I would assume. And but it was never talked about. My grandfather was never talked about. But I grew up with abandonment issues, so go figure, you know. And then my dad, the longer I'm in program, oh my gosh, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and I'm so much like my dad, you know, my wiring. And my dad could have used the principles of this program, Al-Anon. And I'm not sure, I don't think there was alcoholism in his family, but I'm sure if we dig deep enough, we can always find it. You know, it's somewhere. It's somewhere. So, you know, I was this quiet child. I grew up, you know, in northern Maine, both of us did, in this little town, very protected, and you know, and didn't know much about the big world, you know, knew nothing about alcoholism, except it was in my environment. My dad was very, what my dad did for a profession, you know, and then he was very active in the community, and I would hear things like, oh, you know, his foreman, he's a really good worker, but if he's not drinking, he shows up on time, he's a really good worker, you know. And then my dad would be bailing him out of jail, and then, you know, would be going to visit his wife at the hospital, who had jumped out of the car because they had had an altercation, you know, and all of that stuff. So I knew what that looked like. I had kind of a concept of what alcohol, you know, when you drank too much, that's what it looked like. But in my world, that is not what it looked like in my family. So anyway, you know, I went off. I mean, what do you say in a half an hour? You know, I've been here 32 years, and it's like, you know, and there are some specific things, and I really do want to get into the recovery of this program. But so I'm going to fast forward a lot. And you know, I went to college, came back home for a year, and there he was. Like I said, we're from the same hometown, but we're, you know, there's an age difference, and but, you know, one high school, one, you know, parochial school, all of that, and so I knew of him. But my self-worth was, we started dating, and my self-worth was such, you know, I was just ripe for being in an alcoholic relationship, because it brought out, let me tell you, the worst in me. I mean, the worst. And, you know, I thought he was the problem, but when I got here, I started to discover that I had a really big part. It is a family disease, you know, and I've discovered over the years my part in that disease. But so anyway, we started out, you know, the first date, Tom had gotten a 502. So he had lost his license, and so I was picking him up for that. I mean, it's like, you know, it seems so sensible at the time, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems so, wouldn't even give it a thought. But it's like, so I'm picking him up. And my father, now we're from this small town, and if any of you have grown up in a small town, everyone knows everything. And my dad, like I said, was big in the community. And we had this local newspaper, a weekly newspaper, the Aroostook Republican, and everything was in that newspaper. I mean, if you had, you know, if you got anything, everything was in there. So one day my father said, and I'm sure he already knew, but he said, why are you always picking Tom up? Why isn't he ever coming to pick you up? That was my first cover up for him. You know, I came up with this cockamamie excuse, and, you know, there would be many others after that, you know, and it was just like, I thought, and I never thought fast on my feet like that, but boy, I had the answer right there, you know, because I had to, you know, I've come to find out, I mean, I had to look good, you know, I had to look good too, if this was, you know, so I had to make that excuse so I could look good. And we did get married, and got married for all the wrong reasons. What a concept, you know, what a concept. It was the 70s, and after that year, I had moved back to the city, and I had a roommate, but Tom had moved back to the city too, and so he was always at our place, and, you know, listening to, I didn't have the concept of listening to my gut at that time, you know, knew nothing about that, but I had that churning in my stomach, you know, and so he was a fast talker and convinced me that it would be cheaper for him to move in with us, you know, and move in. And I thought, oh my God, you know, and like I said, I had abandonment issues. My father was bigger than life, and I always thought if I, you know, if he disapproved, he was just never going to talk to me again. So my parents lived about, oh, I don't know, 5 hours from us. And so every once in a while, they would call and say they were coming down for a weekend. And oh my gosh, you know, they didn't know that Tom was living there. So I had to, he had to move out lock, stock, and barrel, everything, you know. And so probably after the third time, I said, I proposed to Tom. And I said, we need to get married. You know, we need to get married. And you know, when I look back, that was probably the first honest thing that he really said to me was, you know, I'll get married, but it's just a piece of paper, you know. And I thought, oh, no, it's not just a piece of paper. We'll get married and I'll show you, I'll change you, you know, all of that. So, you know where this is all going, you know. And so had not a clue, you know, and I drank, I partied, but I had such high expectations. I wanted to be such a part of his life. We were just going to be enmeshed, you know, with our feelings. We were going to talk about everything. I was going to know everything, where he went, what he did. And, you know, and as the disease progressed, unbeknownst to me, I became less important all the time. You know, it was just like there were things that took his priority. And Tom was in the restaurant business, and it was a real exciting time. And I became less and less a part of that world. And like I said, I was the one that started having those meaningful conversations at 2 a.m. You know, I was the one that I had the day job. I had the professional job. I had to be, you know, at work at a certain time. And, you know, every morning we would have like before we started work, what do you call it? Like a little meeting. And my boss would say, Jean, you look so tired. And I would just get rigid and go, no, I'm not, you know. And I was. I had slept, you know, a couple hours or 4 or 5 hours a night because I was having those meaningful conversations. But I had to defend that, you know, I had to defend that. And we separated, I think it was 3 times, and that last time was, it was the D word, and he wanted a divorce, and my world was just crumbling, you know. It was like, it was okay for you, but it wasn't okay for me. You know, I had all these pictures of what it was supposed to look like, and we did go through that divorce, and I did not know how, you know, I was going to survive without him. And I look back today, and I go, you know, I mean, that's what my self-worth was at that time. And you know what? I did quite well on my own. And, you know, and what happened was physically Tom, you know, did that geographic and that's his story and came to California. And I'm so grateful for that. And, you know, as I look back, every time, you know, men seem to be my... The men in my life seem to be where I have to grow the most is my journey, you know, with my dad, with one of our sons, with my husband. I mean, that's where the growth has been, you know, has taken me on this journey of just really of acceptance and that. So Tom moved out here and, you know, we did get that divorce and, you know, I was on my own and you know, and I did, like I said, really, really well. And somewhere in that, Tom got sober out here, and he was really the one that told me about the disease of alcoholism. You know, he started calling again. Every time before, it was like every time we separated, you know, there was always that, how can I manipulate? How can I make it work? How can I get him back, you know? And this time, we had gone through this divorce. It was so painful for me. I never wanted to get back into that relationship again. So that's not what I was looking for. But he started calling, and so it was different, and I was hearing something different. In fact, when he got into AA, I'm close to his mother, and we were talking, and she said, oh, Tom joined AA, and I thought, big deal, just another promise, you know. I knew nothing about alcohol, about AA, but so he started calling, and you know, and I say this to my sponsees today, it's not about the talk. You will know when there's a change. I mean, you That's my experience. I just hear it. You know, it's just something that has shifted. You can see the shift. You don't even have to see it. You can just hear the shift. And that's what I was hearing. And somewhere in one of those conversations, Tom said, you know, is there feedback here? I'm just hearing feedback. This is a family disease, and you've been affected by this disease, too. And I thought, I'm getting feedback, okay, sorry. He said, my sponsor says it's a family disease, and you've been affected by this disease, too. And I thought, how dare he say that? You know, you're the problem. You know, I didn't say that to him, but it was like, that's what I thought. You know, he was the problem. And but it was so true. And I was invited out here. He had like 6 months in the program, and you were all waiting for me, you know, with open arms. And I went to a couple. I was only here 5 days. I went to an AA meeting, a couple Al-Anon meetings, and I went back with no desire to get back together. You know, there was no agenda of that at all. And somewhere in that year, Tom called and said, you know, I'd really like to try it again. And I wasn't sure if I did want to try it again, but you know, God was in charge, and just events happened that led me out here. And this is where my journey in Al-Anon started. And I am so grateful. You know, I got into action right away. I got a sponsor right away. One of my first meetings, I heard a speaker talk about being teachable, and I just really heard that. You know, it just opened up a whole world. Well, actually, my first meeting out here, I heard understanding ourselves, and it was like I felt like, I mean, I know today, I know that was the hope, and I know that's where I could really relate, but I didn't know what. You know, at that time, I heard that piece, and it just made me sit up straight and go, oh my gosh, somebody has written down what I didn't even know about myself, you know, that I couldn't articulate that was happening with me. And so, you know, I just got busy right away. And that first year, I just took the body. You know, I didn't think about, oh, gee, I'm tired tonight or whatever. I just took the body, and the feelings followed, you know. And I got a sponsor. Like I said, I got active in the program. And you know, 32 years later, I do the same things today that I did that very first. I've had some really good role models here, you know. I'm still active in the program. I sponsor a lot of women. I call my sponsor at least once a week, and maybe even more. And she lives out of country. But you know what? I do that. And you know, that phone is never heavy for me, because I just know how to do it. You know, it's like it's practice to call in those light times when we can just chit chat. And then when the crap hits the fan, it's like I know what to do. You know, it's not an effort to do it. I mean, it really is. And it's just, you know, and that's what's really kept me excited about this program, is being of service. I've been of service above the group level, and I'm, you know, always of service at the group level. You know, it's not a big deal. I don't care how many years I have getting a chair, putting chairs away or whatever. I'm just another member. You know, it's not about how many years I've been here. I may have a little more experience in certain areas, but it's not about how long I've been here. And, you know, we did get remarried. I moved out here and got married, and we started our family right away, and we have two boys, and they did go to preteen, and one stayed in Alateen, and that's where he found the excitement, and that's where he found his disease. And I don't blame Alateen at all. You know, he was that's where the excitement was for him. And I'm so grateful for that. There's these rooms for our young people too. You know, it is a family disease. And you know, I don't know how much time do I have. About 5 minutes. Okay. So I could spend a whole day on this subject, but we had, like I said, two sons. And when Tom and I talk, he talks, he'll say, our older one, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. He's just like me, like him. And then he'll say, and our younger one, intuitively, he knows how to do life. And I don't know where that came from. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, it came from me. What does he think? You know, it came from me, you know. But it's like, You know, and humor is another thing, because I have found humor here and laughter, because that is so healing for me. You know, it's like I was dim and grim and serious when I came in. It was serious, you know. And I started also going to open AA meetings, and I still go. 32 years I go to an open AA meeting with my husband. That's where I have also found the hope, you know, found the hope there and a little more understanding. But our oldest son is the one that, like I said, he was an Alateen, and he never wanted to be alcoholic, so he defended that right, and he just, whatever, that's his story, but he just, you know, it's been colorful, let's say that. And we've been a parent of having to deal with jails and prisons, and, you know, and that was not my environment, you know, and how to wrap our heads around that, you know, and, you know, and when I look, there was a lot of, you know, today I find, you know, the positive, what do I want to say? That nugget of, you know, that hope, turning it around, that the glass is half full instead of half empty today. And, you know, I was such an enabler. I mean, I'm a mom, you know, I'm a mom. And it was like, you know, just one more time that it looked like he was getting it together. You know, we propped him up and we were going to fix it and do, you know, all of that. And, you know, taking him out of our lives physically for a long time gave us some healing of our family. Our other son, being in program, I would hear, you know, the one that's not, you know, causing a lot of, you know, that you're not expending a lot of energy on, you know, just kind of falls through the cracks, or is just kind of, and I was aware of that because I had been in Al-Anon a long time, but at the same time, even aware of it, that's what was happening, you know, and the walls were going up for him, and he wasn't trusting our judgments because, you know, we would let our son in, he would be gone, you know, there was that inconsistency. So with our son being away, it really helped to heal that relationship with our younger son. He started to have trust in us again. You know, there wasn't any, you know, we all knew that, you know, no one was going to show up at the door, you know, there wasn't going to be a lot of drama. There wasn't going to be a lot of that. So, you know, that has really healed our family. And I have to say, if there's parents here today, you know, Tom and I, just with because of program, it doesn't mean we're always on the same page. You know, he's a father, I'm a mother. We think differently. We do things differently. We process differently. And I wish I had longer to get into that, but I don't. Our son is out today. This is his second term that he's out. And I mean, second time that he's out. And, you know, it's just not having those expectations. He's sober today. You know, I need to allow our family to heal in their own way. All I need to do is have my relationship with the individual children and husband and whatever. And, you know, I'm so grateful for the program, because I don't have to say to our younger son, well, you know, it's your brother's birthday, or it's Christmas, or it's this or that. You should, you know, because I was always, you should, because I wanted to be in control, to make it all nice, all better, all whatever. And, you know, I have just hands off. And I find that if I, you know, because I was also, a lot of my actions were based in fear. And I have found today that making a decision in fear is in not my best interest or anybody else's best interest. And if I can stay in the present and in today, you know, I see her coming over here. You know, it's in my best interest. And I have just really learned how to live a moment at a time, a minute at a time, a day at a time, and just really give the rest to God, you know. And if I can do that, you know, everything else goes well. And I could stand up here today, whether our son was in prison today or not, and say, you know, my life is beautiful, because it is, because I've had to learn how to, it's not about somebody else that's going to make me happy. I need to, you know, I say I'm not going to go down with the alcoholic ship, and I'm not going to go down with the alcoholic ship. So what do I have to do to take care of myself so I'm going to be okay. And I have to say, the first tradition has been vital to me. It's what is good for the whole of the group, the unity of the group. And I have to look at, I am just one entity of that group, you know, one piece of the pie. And, you know, I was always looking to, you know, like I said, our son to, like, try to fix it. And it's like, you know, and somebody told me that, you know, your energies need to go to the people who want to be in your life. You know, the people who want to be loved at this time, not to the people over there. And I really had to learn that, you know. And I thought, the less I talked about him, the less I thought about him, the less I did contrary action, that somewhere I was going to stop loving him, you know. And I had to learn that, I had to learn how to love in a different way. You know, I had to really learn how to do that. Am I done? Almost? Okay. Ah, that's hard over there, looming over there. Melody's looming over there. So anyway, I want to thank the committee. You know what? This is a wonderful program. And like, you know, we get sick. I got sick in this disease, and I can get well in this program, you know. So thank you for having me today. Thank you.
I love just listening to people's stories and know that the program has taught me that all things are from God. And I just have to be patient. And so I learned to have a God box. Anything that's on my mind, I write it down. And perfect resolution, I just have to be patient. All right. Our next speaker will be introduced. Our AA speaker will be introduced by Barry J. From Redondo Beach.
Hi, I'm Barry. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I'm looking out here. I know a lot of you that are in this room right now. And some of you I don't know, but I do consider everybody in this room my family. And, you know, I'm really, it's really a wonderful thing to be here this morning in this family event. And I got to meet this couple over here on Saturday and haven't really spent a lot of time with them. But in the time that I spent with them, I did get to know them a little bit. I got to meet their son. And one thing I found out is that, you know, this program crosses all lines, and I really got a chance to consider them my family. And I want to introduce our AA speaker for today, Tom B.
I'm Tom Bouchard, and I'm an alcoholic. And want to thank our host, Karen and Barry, for taking good care of us, the committee for having us here. I had a great time this weekend, as I always do. My main convention that I've been involved with over the years has been the Southern California. And it's a great convention here. It is the first time we've been here. I can't believe it's been 30 years. But in any case, now you're going to hear a little bit about the other side of the story you just heard. Early on in sobriety, I was probably 3 or 4 years sober. We got invited up to Bakersfield to speak as a couple at a Al-Anon AA function. And I remember sitting there, and Jean went first. And I listened to her story, and I listened to the, you know, where, and I just sat there going, who the hell is she talking about? We suffer from a disease of perception, and I'll tell you, it was like she was talking about a whole different person. I didn't see it the way she saw it at all, and I realized that. You know, Chuck C. used to say he was sitting in his living room and he'd look at Catalina and realize that You know, the people he was working with all saw things differently than he did. You know, we all see things a little bit different. And that was his ability to make some amends to his son at that time. But that's what I understood about, you know, Al-Anons and AAs. We see things differently. I grew up in that same small town, and, you know, as I look back at my life when I got sober, realized that, you know, I could have used a drink or something to change the way I felt from as far back as I can remember. And I had to wait 17 years to do that. So I always felt different, felt alone, felt like I didn't fit. But I don't know if I could have told you that growing up. But as I look back at my life, that's what was going on. I was always uncomfortable. Didn't mean that I didn't, on the outside, do the things I wanted to do or hang with the crowd I wanted to hang with. But I always had that feeling that at any given point they were going to tell me, you know, that's enough, Tom, hit the road. And where that came from, I don't know. Today, as you heard Gene share, we have two boys, grew up with the same parents in the same home, never saw me drink, grew up in program, and they're totally different. So I do understand that this disease has a genetic disposition. There's no question in my mind about that. And I believe I was born with this disease. I just needed to pour a little alcohol on it to get it going. And when I graduated from high school, that summer was the first summer that I got some relief and kicked my disease into play. And as I look back, that's probably a good thing. My son, the oldest, started a little earlier and had difficulty with his life finishing things up. And for me, once I started to drink, this was in the 60s, by the way. I got out of high school when I was 64. In 64. So I'm 130 right now. I look good, huh? But I graduated from high school and started to drink that summer because I'm also one of those guys. My disease works where I did enough to get by. I was always in trouble. This was long before I ever drank. I figured if you drilled holes in the muffler, the car would sound good. That was before I drank. Be one thing if it was my car, but it was my mother's. And the other thing is, she said, boy, that car sounds bad. And I didn't do anything. Wasn't me. And so when I started to drink, I went to school that fall. And that was the tune of my life. I ended up flunking out of school my first year of college because I didn't go to classes. It was much more fun to get out and hitchhike and go places, and I didn't have to account to my parents because I was away at school. The next year, my parents, my mother especially, got me into we talked about mothers, and I know she was, trying to figure out what the heck was going on with me. But I used to hear things like, and this is before I drank too, what the hell were you thinking, Tom? Why did you do that? Or, you know, they just couldn't understand where I was coming from. I'm impulsive. I still have problems with that today. If something seems good, I'll do it and then wonder why I did it. That's why I have a sponsor, and I sponsor a lot of guys. But that next year, my mom got me into a college. Like I said, we come from a small town. This was even smaller, and it's a town she grew up in and just happened to have a little university there or a little college there. And she said, for God's sakes, Tom, don't embarrass me. And I thought I heard her say, don't flunk out. So I managed to get myself kicked out of that school. by the end of the year and drafted. And then I, again, was upset because it's never my fault. It's always your fault. And it was that coach. And then it was the draft board. And I'll show them. And I went down and joined the Navy. And then realized I was in for 4 years instead of two. And that was the way my life went. Didn't want to be in the Navy. So, you know, when you do that, you got to have income. You're not going anywhere in the grade. They gave me E3 out of boot camp, which anybody that's been in the military, that's just a grade higher than you come out. Gives you a little more money, but I came out 4 years later E3. And you hear stories about, you know, I did this, that, and got busted. I just went 4 years, same rate, never got busted, because I really didn't want to be there. But it was a good place to drink. I started to get into the restaurant business as an outside source so I could earn some more income. And basically got out of the service somehow 4 years later with an honorable discharge. I know how it happened. I worked for officers instead of a non-com. If I'd have answered to anybody, I'd have been kicked out for sure with my drinking and my antics and not coming in for musters and things like that. But I got out of the service, went back to school, and that is basically when I met Jean. And as she said, you know, I was on a quest my whole life to fix Tom. Didn't realize that's what I was doing, but nothing ever seemed to work. And I knew a lot of, by that time I'm out of the service, I'm 6 years out of high school, and most of my guys that I know have gotten married, they're having kids, and I figured, well, maybe that'll fix it. And I just didn't have a clue I was the problem. And I was a functioning alcoholic. Jean and I got married, and what we talk about in AA are resentments. They'll kill us. Resentments, that's what I would get. I'd get a resentment, and then it would be like, adios, see you later, pick a fight, do whatever, and we'd split up, and then I'd go hurt myself. In the restaurant business, I was alcoholic, but I was no dummy. I found a good friend that owned a few restaurants, and I went to work for him, and he drank just like I did. So the last 10 years of my drinking were great. You know, I ran restaurants and drank and ate for free. Music. Cell phones are great, aren't they? Mine vibrates in my pocket. Anyway, we got married, and I worked in the restaurant business, and you know, everything alcohol did for me, what nothing else could. You know, it became my best friend. It was the primary thing in my life, and somehow I functioned. And I came to a point when I was in 1980 where it just wasn't working the way my father died suddenly. He was 62 years old at the time, and I know that affected me, but I had been drinking and using on a daily basis for so long that I was sort of numb to the whole situation, but I know it had an effect, and Jean and I were split up, and I thought, I came up with, a brilliant idea. You know how we come up with those great ideas. And I figured if I divorced her, if I quit my job, and I got out of Dodge, I'd be okay. Everything would be fine. And since I had some experience in the service in Hawaii and California, and I love warm weather, that's where I came. I hit Laguna Beach, drank with my cousin there, and I wasn't in California 6 hours, I don't think, and I realized I felt the same way I did when I left Maine. And I didn't know anything about our program. It just scared the hell out of me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. It was a bar manager of mine who I'd let go in back east, because he couldn't stay on a bar stool on his day off, and I had looked him up in Culver City to party with him, and it just so happened he had a DUI, reduced to reckless driving, and he was about 60 days sober in the Pacific Group and had a sponsor, and he was in the middle of the activity there. And all that Ray had to do was open the door, and I could see in his eyes what we see in somebody's eyes when they come alive in the program. And I said, Ray, you look good. And he told me he wasn't drinking. And I thought, wow, really? And I just didn't know how you didn't do that. I'd been doing it for 17 years now. I was 34 years old, and I told him, well, then let's smoke a joint. And he looked at me, and he goes, look, Tom, I don't do anything that affects me from the neck up. And that just blew me away. It was like, how do you have any fun? How do you do anything? But he's the one that took me to my first meeting, which was Ohio Street. I didn't know what you guys were about. All I knew was the drunk was the guy I had that came in to panhandle the bar or the restaurant, and I had to get rid of. You know, to me, that was an alcoholic. And the people in this room looked good. They all scared the hell out of me because I was so fearful of everything in my life without something in my system. And after that first meeting, what I was to find out later is I found some hope because I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I thought, you know what? If Ray can stay sober, maybe I can. Now, Ray saved my life that day, and, you know, I've lost contact with Ray. He's been in and out and hasn't been able to stay sober. But he saved my life over 33 years ago, and, you know, that's the way this program works. You know, I pray for him, and I hope that he eventually finds this thing before it kills him. But, you know, he saved my life that day. And that was my beginning. After, you know, I just started to do things in program. I got a sponsor on that Wednesday. On that Friday, I was 5 days sober, and I had an interview with Charlie Browns, the regional manager back then, and this was 1981, and he offered me, you know, an assistant managership for 6 months, and if I liked him and they liked me, they'd give me my own restaurant, and it was more money than I had ever seen, and I took the job. Then I called this thing they called a sponsor, who I'd gotten on a Wednesday, to give him the good news, and what he told me was, you can't take that job. And I thought, you're crazy. You know, and I know today it was my higher power working in my life. You know, somehow or another, my head told me, you know, he's right. I knew the kind of hours and the times I'd have to put in, and I wouldn't get to meetings, and I would definitely drink again. Somehow that came to play. And that Friday night, I told him, I'll do anything you want. And I realized it was the first time in my life that when I wanted to do something, I did it, period. I didn't care whether my parents told me no, didn't make any difference. This was the first time in my life where I took a contrary action to how I felt. And that's been the name of the game for the last 33 plus years, is taking contrary action on a daily basis. Because, you know, even today, my head tells me all the time, you don't need to do this. You don't need to go there. You don't need to be of service. My disease is alive and well between my ears. Just because I don't drink doesn't make any difference. It's not the alcohol. It wasn't the drugs. It's what goes on between my ears. And it's as alive today as it was over 33 years ago. And the only way that I can defend that is to be in these rooms and with you people. And like Gene said, you know, I think we knew from about 2 years old when our boy, he didn't like the word no. In fact, you know, it just wasn't part of his vocabulary, and he would just, you know, go and go and go until he got a different answer or got a surrender from us some way or another. And you know, we've had, like I said, we've had to watch his journey. You know, the 20s have not, his well, really, from the time he was probably 18 on, and he's 31 today, we've had to watch the progression of this disease in our own kid, and it's hard. Like Gene said, it's you know, I've never bailed him out. I've tried to, but he's your kid, and you're gonna, you know, you always have that hope that it's gonna be different this time. And like Gene said, this last little stretch has definitely, you know, I could hear that 180 turn. I could hear it, and the last 9 months he's been out, I can see it. And it's strictly through the actions we take, because that's what this whole program's about. It's not what I think between my ears, it's what I do on a daily basis. You know, it's all about the actions I take. I'm trustworthy because I take trustworthy actions, not because of what I think. You know, and that's what I look at today. I look at that in the people around me, and the examples that are out there, in the old timers, and even in the newcomers. You know, it's all about what they're doing. And I was taught early on, if you do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it, be where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there, those two things will keep any human being in good stead in their lives, not just alcoholics. And you know, I got the opportunity yesterday to spend some of the afternoon working on a fifth step with a guy that I got to know on a panel I take into prisons. And you know, he's 56 years old, and from the time he's been 13, he's been institutionalized, you know, up until 60 days ago, you know. And I sit there and work with him, and I realize how difficult it is for us to live in the world, you know, how hard it is for the alcoholic to function in society. You know, I'm glad that I'm so glad and so grateful that when I first came in, I heard from the podium, if your problem's alcohol or your problem is drugs, then you're in the wrong place. And I didn't understand that until I heard him explain it further, which was basically, we have a living problem. And that turned on the light bulb. Because I can look back at my life in the first 17 years, and I had a living problem long before I ever took a drink. You know, my disease was active from a standpoint of being able to function and feel okay with myself, and not on the outside, but on the inside. You know, this whole thing has been about feeling okay with Tom on the inside. I have a I grew up in a parochial school. How much time do I have? Jeez, I think I got more time than my wife. Usually she goes first, and I get the last 5-10 minutes. I'm not used to doing this. Anyway, no, not true. I have, you know, I grew up, I came up with the nuns the first 8 years, and I heard in the Catholic religion, you know, if you thought it, it was the same as doing it. And whatever that may be. So I knew I was going downstairs by the time I was 12, 13 years old. And I didn't know what to do about that. I didn't know how to handle that stuff. And I was an altar boy, and I used to help myself to, you know, one or two envelopes out of the basket because they didn't pay me enough to... That was my justification. They didn't pay me enough to say Mass 5 mornings a week at 6 a.m. And so you can see that, you know, I was a liar, cheat, and a thief long before I ever took a drink. And the thing that I've found here is, you know, that higher power that I grew up with, or that concept that I grew up with, I was able to come to you folks, and you told me it doesn't make any difference what you have as a higher power. And it was kind of neat for me to be able to take the good parts and put that to work in my life and just work on that end of it. I didn't know that I could just let the rest of it go. And so, you know, I've been able to have a relationship with a higher power over my sobriety that has continued to get better in my life from a standpoint of trusting that if I just show up and I do the next appointed thing and be of service to God's kids, that I'll be okay. And I'll tell you one other thing. When I was about 12 years sober, I had started my own business, and we were going great guns. This was, I think I started the business in 85 or 86, and we were, you know, selling computer chips. We were doing great. And when the business started to go, these shortages for computer chips started to go south by 89. You know, things got smaller, did more stuff. In any case, I found myself having to close that business in 92. We tried to diversify. We tried to do a number of things. And from 90 to 92 was a turn down like it's been the last 4 or 5 years. And it wasn't good. And I was looking for work. And I was sending out resumes, and I couldn't get anything. I couldn't even get an interview. And then I spoke one night, and somebody came up and said, well, you've had restaurant experience, you've had sales experience. Have you ever thought of the other side of the industry, which is like Cisco, Rykoff, selling to restaurants? I hadn't even entered my mind. So within a week, I had a couple interviews. And one company wouldn't hire me. And then this company, Cisco, had said, we'll hire you, we'll give you... It was $500 a week back then, and my mortgage was over $3,000. So I went to my sponsor, and he said to me, "Take the job, kid." And I said, "But I'll lose the house." He said, "Take the job." And I couldn't see, you know, didn't make any sense to me. It was like I needed to keep looking to find something that was going to, you know, keep my family afloat and. You know, keep us in the house and that kind of thing. That was my thought process. It took me a number of years, but I took the job because he told me to. And I'd learned over the years that my way of looking at things isn't necessarily the right way. And when I'm having conflict, I go to him and he gives me direction and I take it. I don't argue with it anymore. But in my head, I thought he was nuts. So I took the job. 2 years later, we had to walk away from the house. And in those 2 years, boy, I tell you, I kept saying to myself, I knew I was right. I knew I was right on that one. So we walked away from the house, and that was tough. And we went through a lot of tough times from 92 to 96, 97. But I'll tell you, 2 years ago, I retired from Cisco. After being with him a little over 19 years, and it was the best move he made, because I wouldn't have. You know, they had a pension plan. They had everything going, and unbeknownst to me, you know, I just showed up and did the job, and it was the heyday for Cisco in Southern California. So it turned out to be the best move, like I said, that could have been made. But those are the kinds of things where, you know, my thinking doesn't work, but somebody else's, and I was trying to explain to this guy yesterday, you know, anybody else will come up with a better decision for me than I will. Anybody. It doesn't make any difference who I talk to, because what's coming out of my mouth is the problem, not all the emotions and the feelings tied up in it. And you'll always get a better response. I am so grateful to this program for the opportunity to, you know, like Gene said, we have our ups and downs, but there were two things that when we got back together and got remarried, there were two things. One from Gene that said, I need you to be faithful. And the second one was from my sponsor at the time, said, you don't get to run anymore. So I've had to work on those resentments. And, you know, because I don't get to go anywhere. You know, I got to stay there. And it's been the best thing in the world. You know, we have a great relationship. We have a great relationship with those kids. And none of that would be possible without Al-Anon AA. I am so grateful to live today with the center being my program of AA, and that we have Al-Anon in our house to the extent that we do. I want to thank you for our lives. Thanks.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.